I'm Molly Wansell.
And I'm Geoffrey Wansell.
And for the last 16 years or thereabouts, we have been having lunch every Saturday, and often our conversation turns to murder.
And that's what's prompted us to launch this true crime podcast called Blood Ties.
Hi, everyone. I'm Molly Wansell, and I'm here with my father, Geoffrey Wansell, back for the Blood Ties podcast.
Welcome back. Thank you so much for coming and for listening to it. It's an enormous pleasure. I seem to be talking about murder a lot these days, but I think it reflects the fact that people like to hear about it.
Hopefully this is your favourite place to talk about murder.
Well, it's certainly my favourite place.
Yeah, I would hope so. I'd be deeply offended otherwise. How are you, Dad? I haven't seen you for ages. It's literally the first time I've seen Dad for 2.5 weeks or something.
Well, I was in the Tunisian Sahara reworking my second novel, which I'm really quite pleased, which is about a stand-up comedian who gets a stalker and with terrible consequences. But I'm really quite proud of it. I think it works. And it was very nice to spend, I spent 5 days with it, literally, you know, on my new laptop, massaging it and making it a little better. But I like the story. I think the story works. And one of the things I've got kind of used to now, and maybe it's a bit like this podcast, is in the end, I think I'm a storyteller. And I think we try and do that in these podcasts. And I think I tried to do that in the novel, and I think I try and do it in the televisions that I do.
You do it in your fiction writing, though, too, no? Every time you write about a... You write a biography, you're telling their story, no?
I am, and I think that that's a very... It's a very nice thing to be, you know? Rather old-fashioned, but it's incredibly valuable, because all the way back to medieval times, ancient Rome, Greece, there were always storytellers, people who used to arrive and say, let me tell you a story, and recapture or imagine something. And I think it's a very grand thing to try and do.
It's very difficult to do well, I think.
Well, I don't know if I do it well, but I do believe that it's a very interesting thing to try and do.
Yeah.
And that, in a way, is sort of what we're talking about, isn't it? You know, it's recreating a time and place, a person.
That's what we're trying to do here on our podcast, for sure.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
And isn't that rather special?
Yeah, very special.
Just as you know, and we've said before, I've been doing this series for CBS, and the director and I came to the conclusion that what we were really doing wasn't presenting a story, it was telling a story, which is actually a very interesting distinction.
Yeah, I agree. Also, you don't want to just present a story to your viewer or to your listener or to your reader.
Or to our podcast audience.
You want to make it engaging and interesting. And
so they get the flavour of what is going on.
Exactly.
And I think that's very exciting. But what have you been doing while I've been away?
I didn't end up going to Cannes because my flight was 5 hours delayed. So I basically would have ended up going just for dinner. So that didn't work out too well. When did I last see you? I can't remember.
Just
what
before
been doing.
You tried to go to Cannes.
Just before I tried to go to Cannes. I tried to go to Cannes. Didn't go to Cannes. Stayed at home. Worked. Nothing of huge interest. Just been at work. Haven't been having the smoothest of times, but I'm sure it will pick up.
Agents never have smooth times.
No, I suppose not.
They don't. It's in the DNA.
Well,
you don't get smooth
even though
times.
I didn't make it to Cannes, but TV show did win 2 awards at the Cannes Series competition, so that's very good.
That's terrific.
They won Best Script and Best Music.
Well, that's wonderful.
So that was very good.
That's very, very good.
So, yeah, that's it really. Just been doing, you know, the day-to-day.
The day-to-day.
The day-to-day. Not much to report. Surprisingly quiet, really, for me.
Well,
not much going
it's
on.
It's been quiet-ish for me. I've done...
It was very hot here.
Yes, I know.
That was basically the
news. We were very envious.
Oh, really? Because it wasn't hot in the desert?
Well, it was very variable in the Sahara. Very. I mean, I do mean we had sandstorms. They'd had an awful lot of wind in the Sahara all through March. And the end of it was just kind of flowing through. And it was beautiful in bits, but very complicated in other bits. And you'd had a heat wave here.
We did. I mean, it was too hot, though. Which, I turned your heater off.
Quite right.
You came in and your heater was on.
Tunisia is a wonderfully chaotic country, full of very sweet people, but utterly chaotic. You cannot really rely on anything, except perhaps just the airline.
You're a bit of an old hand at Tunisia now.
I am, yes. This is my nth visit.
It is nth, isn't it?
And you begin to get it a bit wiser. You get a little bit smarter about it.
You've got a routine down.
Sort of. You can never get Tunisia down to routine because it always kicks you. You think you have.
Think you've got it. You haven't.
You haven't. You never have.
Tells you what's what.
Mm.
Good, cool. Yeah, no, I wish I had more news, but I don't, so.
Well, that's all right.
There you go.
Well, I don't have masses of news. I haven't, you know. But let's do...
Yeah, who are we talking about this week?
This is a man called Stephen Port.
We are dubbing him the Grindr Slayer.
The Grindr Killer.
The Grindr Killer.
This one is not the gay slayer. A man called Colin Ireland, who operated in Earl's Court in London.
Okay.
This one is called the Grindr Killer. Also operated in London, but in East London, not West.
Okay, done. Okay, great. So this is the Grindr Killer.
Yes. Stephen Port was born on the 22nd of February 1975 in Southend-on-Sea in Essex. But he and his parents moved to Dagenham, where he grew up, and where they still live.
His parents?
Yeah.
Yeah.
He was a loner as a child, an only child, I think, with what was described later as a childlike personality. Even as a young adult, for example, he played with children's toys.
What kind of toys?
Garages and...
Cars
that you rolled along.
Mm-hmm.
There's not much doubt that he was uncertain about his sexuality from a pretty early age. But he didn't actually come out as gay until he was nearly 30.
Was he an only child?
Yeah, I think he was an only child. There are many allegations that when he left his parents' house in Dagenham and moved to Barking, which is not that far, no, two stops.
Not far at all.
On the district line, that he was a rent boy. Now, that may or may not be true, but what is true is that Port developed an appetite for pretty serious gay pornography, particularly of older men attacking younger.
Men, not boys.
Boys. Now, this may have been a result, and I can only speculate on this, this may have been a result of his own experiences, that when he was young, he did allow himself to be a rent boy and therefore resented what had happened to him. But what is not in any doubt is that he left his parents' house, moved to Barking in a flat, and he was a chef. He worked at the West Ham bus garage for really quite a long time. He was also a fantasist. He invented, oh, I was in the Navy, I went to Oxford University. He created all sorts of myths about himself. He actually was a not tremendously intelligent, but rather smart man who quickly began to lose his hair. Not, you would have thought, the ideal Lothario for young men.
I'm sure there's a lot of attractive bald men out there.
Well, I have no hair myself, I'm absolutely believe there are.
God forbid we describe you as a Lothario, Dad.
No, I don't think that would be right. I certainly wouldn't. But he quite quickly began to lose his hair. And at one point, he went out and bought a very, very expensive blonde toupee for £900, which he said no one could tell it was a toupee.
Everyone can tell when you're wearing a toupee.
Everyone can tell.
Losing your hair is very demasculating is not a word that actually exists. But it's
emasculating.
Emasculating, that's the one. It's very emasculating, isn't it? It's like a stressful thing if you're a guy with a nice head of hair and you lose your hair. And you can speak from experience. I remember you talking about it a lot when I was a kid.
Yeah, I think losing your hair is very difficult. I suppose Prince William must feel that a bit.
He must do. I was wondering whether Harry will lose his hair.
It doesn't look to me like he will.
I don't know. Geoffrey always used to blame Timothée shampoo as the reason he'd lost his hair.
No, Head and Shoulders.
Was it Head and Shoulders?
Yeah.
I thought it was Timothée.
Well, one or the other. Anyway,
Timothée doesn't even exist anymore.
It's still an allegation. I didn't really, you know, they couldn't possibly
prove it.
Prove it.
Other shampoos are available.
Yeah, many other shampoos are available, and probably my hair was bound to fall out. But my grandfather's hair on both sides didn't fall out.
Your son's hair is very luscious.
And my son's.
So shows no signs of being defeated. Anyway.
So here we have a chef who, believe it or not, in 2014 appears on Celebrity MasterChef wearing a toque and smiling at the camera.
Oh, okay. Just so Geoffrey has his sort of Googled some pictures. He's sort of like a chef in the background in an episode of.
Yes.
Not an actual contestant.
No, so but he working, helps them make pasta.
He's working in the kitchen.
And meatballs for 100 bus drivers.
Oh, okay. So they're doing the giant catering challenge.
That's
those
right.
So MasterChef aficionados.
Okay. 2014, he appears on Celebrity MasterChef. He does, however, have what could best be described as an extremely dark secret, which is essentially that he has these fantasies of controlling young men whom he calls twinks and having sex with them while they're unconscious, or at least not compos mentis,
semi-conscious.
He uses in his fantasy the date rape jug GHB and another variety of cocktail of drugs, poppers, crystal meth, Viagra, all sorts. Now, it's conceivable that his intention was to cause his victims serious harm, but possibly not to kill them.
And what do you mean?
Well, I think he may have wanted simply to subdue them. Now, I'm not saying for one second, I'm absolutely not saying for a second that he wasn't a merciless killer.
But that doesn't make sense, because he's already subdued them by making them take drugs that make them semi-conscious.
But they didn't know they were taking them.
Right, so he's drugged people.
Yeah. That's his turn on.
Oh, sorry. So we haven't got to that. Do they die of overdoses, these people?
We'll find out. That's where it gets interesting.
Okay.
The motive is clearly sexual. He wishes to subdue the victims, to control the victims, so they cannot object. They are, if you like, slabs of meat or objects. But for him, they are his fantasy, which he's been living out by looking at a lot of hardcore gay porn videos, mostly of older men attacking boys. He liked particularly smaller, boyish men. He didn't want big, bulky men. He himself was not tremendously handsome, but...
Tall and thin, isn't
quite
he?
Quite tall, quite thin, thin-faced. But how can I put it? He was convincing. His first victim was a man called Anthony Walgate, age 23, originally from Hull, who to some extent was in the rent boy arena. He was a part-time escort. He advertised online. He was a little bit naive. Before his killing, Port had attacked and raped other young men, but who had escaped death. Tragically, Anthony Walgate didn't. On the 17th of June 2014, Port offered him £800 for an overnight in his flat in Barking. At 8 a.m. on the 19th, a day and a half later, Port was found outside, ironically. I'm sorry, Walgate was found outside Port's flat. Port had called the police at 8 o'clock that morning and said there was a man outside his block of flats who'd either had a seizure or was drunk. Actually, Walgate was dead.
Well, where outside was he?
Well, Port had a flat in a smallish block, and the body was lying opposite the entrance. Now, Port called the police anonymously. This is where the story gets a little bit complicated. The police think that Walgate has simply taken an overdose. He's another gay man who's overdosed. He had lots of GHB in his system, lots of other drugs, including crystal meth. The forensic, you know, the post-mortem revealed that he was...
And how did he end up outside Port's flat?
They didn't seem to be too interested in
weren't
that.
Too concerned?
No.
Okay.
Port later admitted that, quotes, he panicked when he found Walgate's body outside and was eventually convicted for perverting the course of justice by not telling the police the truth. Actually, he was being very shrewd. Port realised that he's dumped the body outside the front door and he wants to make sure nobody thinks he's killed him. He's drugged him, made love to him, and in the end...
I think that's a delicate way of putting it.
Well, and the drugs have taken Walgate's life. The police in Barking do not display the greatest of interest, and I'm putting it politely, because well, it's another gay, and well, he's taken a lot of drugs, and well, we've got other things to do. And I'm not being unfair to the Metropolitan Police here.
No, I remember. Yeah, I remember it. His mum didn't think that, though, did she?
No.
I remember his mum.
Yeah. His mum was very, very upset.
Mm.
So although the police take some interest in this first killing, Port is jubilant. He's had his way.
Totally got away with it.
Killed Walgate, dumped him outside his front door, and no one's arrived to say, excuse me, sir, are we going to charge you with murder? In the next 2 months, August and September 2014, Port kills twice more. His second victim is a man called Gabriel Kovari, 22, originally from Slovakia, who was briefly Port's, quotes, flatmate slash lover. His third victim was a man called Daniel Whitworth from Gravesend in Kent, who was 21, also a chef, interestingly. So now you've had Walgate found outside the flat. You have two more victims. Now, this time, Port poses the victims in the graveyard of St. Margaret's Church in Barking. He puts them up against a wall, back to it, across. By an extraordinary coincidence, the same woman walking her dog finds both bodies.
In Hannibal Lecter, Thomas Harris revealed the face of true evil. Now in Kari Mora, he shows us the strength of absolute courage. From the legendary author of The Silence of the Lambs comes the new novel, Kari Mora. Out now in hardback, ebook, and audiobook, narrated by Thomas Harris.
Hi, I'm Ramesh Ranganathan, and I'm just bending you here to tell you about my brand new BBC Tea show.
Give it up for the Ranganation!
A topical comedy chat show about all of the things that are happening from the news, the country, the internet.
This is unbelievable, right?
To help me make sense of it all, they've given me my very own focus group. The bunch of fun, opinionated and passionate people from all walks of life. And of course my mum, who apparently has to be in everything I do now.
You missed a few things.
No, I didn't.
You did!
The Ranganation, available now on BBC iPlayer until July the 22nd.
Well, probably not extraordinary coincidence. Dog walkers probably walk their dog.
But
at the
I think it's
time.
Pretty extraordinary. You find two dead bodies within a matter of 3 weeks of each other.
Yeah, I mean, but the guy who lived round the corner is murdering them and putting them in the same place.
Yeah, so yeah,
on your dog walk.
Yeah, you're in. I mean, it is bizarre. But the police see them both as
quite a lot of bother to get a body out like that. You have to prop it up somewhere.
He was quite a strong.
You've got
man.
To be pretty strong.
Strong.
And you've got to be quite a bit because it's like a dead weight.
Yes, literally.
Which is why we so often talk about dismemberment because it's Lester very
carry.
Difficult to carry a full body it on is. Your own.
It is. But Port nevertheless managed. It wasn't very far from his flat. Probably about 150 yards.
That's what I mean.
To the graveyard. So, now we have the murder in June of Walgate, the murder in August of Kovari, the murder in September of Whitworth, except they're none of them thought of as murders. They're all conceived as drug overdoses.
Oh, that's ridiculous. They think two bodies propped up against the same wall.
In the same place.
In the same place are both overdose.
Oh, it's a coincidence.
That's crazy.
The boys in blue, I'm afraid, don't come out of this terribly well. There's even an inquest. The inquest returns an, quotes, open verdict. Though to her eternal credit, The coroner was very, very unhappy and said, why was there no proper forensic examination? Why Whitworth's parents, for example, were told, oh, he's killed himself. Get over it. Port was so clever. He wrote a suicide note purporting to be from Whitworth, saying that Whitworth had killed Kavari and therefore he'd killed himself.
Ah, okay.
So you've now had three killings, June, August and September 2014. You've got two bodies in the graveyard, Kavari and Whitworth. Whitworth has written, I quote, a suicide note, actually not written by Whitworth at all, but written by Port. Now, the police never properly established whether or not it was Whitworth's handwriting. They only gave Whitworth's parents an example, an exemplar, and they weren't sure. They didn't give them the whole note. It was the most extraordinary botch up. And I'm not being rude, and there were a lot of IPCC investigations which are only now coming to a conclusion. So Kavari and Whitworth are placed in the graveyard by Port with a fake suicide note saying, I killed Kavari and now I've killed myself. And there's plenty of evidence they've taken lots of drugs. Well, they would do, wouldn't they? After all, Port's been giving them plenty.
Yeah.
So Port now, the boys in blue, quite rightly, have arrived at his door and said, I think you were rather putting our leg about Wallgate. I mean, you knew more about it, didn't you, than you let on. And he said, well, actually, I did know a bit more about it, but I mean, I sort of knew him and I didn't have anything to do with it. And so in March 2015, he gets sentenced to 8 months imprisonment for perverting the course of justice for the killing of Wallgate. Death of Wallgate, not the killing.
Perverting the course of justice,
not telling the truth.
But not telling the truth.
What he knew about Wallgate.
That he knew Wallgate.
Yeah. Essentially, he's saying, oh, yes, I might have known him, but I didn't know anything about his death. So he gets 8 months. He serves 3.5. He gets out of jail in June 2015. Well, he must think he can walk on water. I mean, he's killed by this point 3 people. He's been on MasterChef. At one point, he writes a letter from jail on remand to a friend saying, there are no other celebrities on the wing with me. I'm the only person who's been on television.
That's crazy.
No, but that's the distorted reality, isn't it? That's the difference between, you know, what you and I would see as common sense and what other people see as a fetish, as a fantasy. So, in August 2015, he picks up a fourth victim, Jack Taylor, who lived with his parents in Dagenham and worked as a night shift forklift truck driver. Jack suffers the same fate. He doesn't end up in St. Margaret's, though, but nearby, not far from Port's flat. Taylor's family are appalled, and particularly his sister, are appalled by the fact that the police swallow the story that he had yet again taken another drugs overdose. It's the same, oh, these are gay men who have taken drugs overdoses. They're not, you know, not really significant. His sister in particular says, I do not believe it. Jack was incredibly anti-drugs. He may have been gay, but he was incredibly anti-drugs. And thanks to the Taylor family, who absolutely insisted that Jack wasn't involved in drugs, didn't enjoy them, the whole debate started about, well, hang on, who was Jack with in the last moments, you know, last hours of his life?
And that just, we haven't discussed how he met these men, but I don't think he would be called a Grindr killer if he hadn't met them.
Well, he was on a number of websites, Grindr in particular, but another one which I took a note of, which I thought was very interesting, called Fast Boys or... no, Fit Lads it's called. The Fit Lads website.
Fit Lads?
Fit Lads.
Okay. Where you find fit lads.
Yes. It all depends what floats your boat.
You're looking for.
But he used a lot of websites. But Grindr, it was the Sun who really dubbed him the Grindr killer.
Okay. But the thing is that these men that he was meeting and these, you know, this, what's the latest victim called? Jack.
Jack Taylor.
He didn't have any, so he was, they literally, that was the first time they'd met in every instance.
Yes. Yeah. It was always the first time they'd met. And it was always.
And he always spiked their.
Always spiked their drinks.
You have to do quite a lot of heavy spiking to get all that in someone's system, did he?
Well, I think it was always wine. All I would say is that you have to be incredibly careful. And we talk about this a lot, don't we? You know, don't get in cars with strangers.
Trust no one. Don't leave your drink anywhere.
Don't leave your drink.
I mean, I do agree a bit. I'm not dissing anybody who goes on dating websites or apps or anything. But I do think we find it incredibly easy these days to give, a lot of our personal details out very freely over the internet. And also just to trust someone implicitly very quickly.
Yeah.
A bit like the story I told you that I overheard the other day in that restaurant about the man who'd ended up fathering a child from a one-night stand off a Tinder date.
Mm.
And he didn't know about it for a whole year.
Pretty anyway, frightening, really, isn't it?
I digress.
But the point about... Port was sufficiently clever, not only to believe that he'd got away with Walgrave, but also to put this false trail down about Kavari and Whitworth. And I think then became convinced that he could take another victim without any problem at all.
But the issue was is that Jack's family knew that he wouldn't have taken drugs by choice.
No. But it took a very long time for Jack Taylor's family to convince the police. First of all, can we see the CCTV of where Jack was? There was a lot of CCTV. Oh no, we're not going to show it to you. It's not relevant. Hang on a minute. Was he with somebody? Well, he may have been, but it's not, you know.
Well, it's quite a lot to decide to take a whole bunch of dangerous drugs together on your own all at one point and then wander around and end up dead somewhere.
Yes. But we are in East London in 2015, and a lot of the family have accused, particularly Barking Dagenham and police, of homophobia.
Unsurprisingly.
So, after a great deal, and I pay great tribute to the Taylor family, after a great deal of pressure, the police release CCTV images of Jack and another man that night, the night of Taylor's death. The other man is identified within literally hours as Stephen Port. And that was the reason that Port was eventually, within a matter of 36 hours, arrested and charged with the murders of all four gay men. Now, you could say that joining the dots would have been easier After all, you get four gay men killed, two in the same churchyard, all within a radius of 200 yards of Port's flat, one outside the door. He's already been sentenced for perverting the course of justice. It doesn't take Sherlock Holmes to think something might be going on. But they didn't. In November 2016, Port is convicted, found guilty by a jury, it didn't take them any time at all, of the murders of Woolgate, Gavari, Whitworth and Taylor. He's also found guilty of four rapes, four sexual assaults by penetration, 10 counts of administering a substance with intent to abuse, in other words, date rape drugs. And on the 25th of November, he's given a whole life sentence. And the judge said, and I think it bears repeating, a chilling and calculated use of the drug GHB, which he administered without their permission. Now, a lot of the evidence came late. There was Port's neighbour, there was Kavari's previous flatmate, there was all sorts of things. Now, the Pink News and the Met's LGBT unit were both convinced that there was something going on. But the police in East London were, how can one put it, not convinced. They accepted the suicide note, the quotes fake suicide note that he left with Whitworth. They told his family that that's what it is, get over it, deal with it. It wasn't the Met's finest hour, to be fair. But Port was very convincing. I mean, here's a man who presents himself, he's been on MasterChef, he has a toupee. He sees himself as rather, you know, a bit of a glam.
I'm not sure being in the background of MasterChef and having a toupee is a way of presenting yourself as like a...
But for him it was. For him, this was his real life. You know, I am a celebrity. And he's finally given a whole life sentence. He will never be released. But 17 officers of the Met were subject to an investigation by the Independent Police Complaints Commission, now called something slightly different. The results of that investigation have yet to be released.
Still. I don't think it takes a rocket scientist to work that out.
Well, it is still going on, so we cannot prejudge what it is. It was said to have been completed by the spring of 2018, where we are now, but it has not been completed and it has not been released. Stephen Port was plausible, clever, organised, and utterly ruthless, depraved in every way. And there is nothing you can say by way of exculpation for him.
Do you not? You mentioned earlier that maybe he didn't mean to give them so much drugs. Do you think he did mean to? Or?
I think he knew very well that the drugs he gave them could well cause them ultimately lethal harm.
Also, I mean, what's he going to... How's he going to... I suppose you said he had a lot of victims before who just... I suppose you just wake up thinking, oh, I've done something I shouldn't.
I've done the wrong
remember.
Thing. Yeah, yeah. It's interesting to say, too, that the families of the victims have launched a civil suit against the Metropolitan Police for their failure to join the dots and to say we had a serial gay murderer on the loose in East London. It'll be fascinating to see what happens.
Well, we'll see. There you go.
Stephen Port.
Thanks, Dad. Very interesting.
It is actually a very interesting story.
Yeah, it is interesting.
Yeah.
Definitely. I was thinking then about when we talk about something jolly, but I was wondering whether you, I suppose you haven't had time since you got back to work out what you're going to watch next on Netflix.
I haven't, no. I've barely had a minute to turn around.
I started watching The Alienist, which you might take a look at, which is a adaptation of a book set in New York in the late 19th century about a psychologist and an illustrator and the first woman ever to work within the police department to investigate the death of young boys. So far I've only watched two episodes, who are also escorts or what's the word,
prostitutes,
yeah, exactly. But they have very, like, horrible, mutilating deaths. And he kind of gathers together a group of strange, sort of like on the sidelines of investigation. I think it's interesting because the police are portrayed as being, like, very corrupt and just working with certain people in the system for money and blah, blah, blah.
Yeah.
And these guys are kind of working against the system to try and find the true identity of a very brutal serial killer.
It sounds interesting. I'll have a look. Called The Alienist.
The Alienist. I don't know how much I like it yet, but I'll probably stick with it for the...
Oh, I would.
I like the director a lot. The director's a guy who directed... London Spy. I don't know if you ever watched that.
Oh, yeah,
that.
I did.
I thought that was a really good show.
Yeah.
With Ben Whishaw and Charlotte Rampling.
Yes. Very good show.
Good show.
I haven't seen very much since I've been back.
No, obviously.
I haven't really had a chance.
Thought that might be your...
I've
you could have a look
I've
at that.
Looked at a couple of books. The book that we mentioned, the true crime book... about the killer in the Golden Gate Killer, has been a huge success in America.
Oh, really?
Absolutely colossal success. And remember the lady who died? She didn't finish it.
Yeah, that was very interesting.
And it's been a most extraordinary, number one New York Times.
Fantastic.
And I do applaud it. I think it's the best true crime, American true crime, since In Cold Blood, which I hugely admire, Capote's book. It's very nice. I did a thing on Monday for my old friend Brian Masters, who wrote, I think, the best of the British true crime books, which is his book about Dennis Nielsen called Killing for Company. Brian's an old friend, and I'm a huge admirer of that book. And Brian wrote to Nielsen after seeing him on remand carrying a copy of Shakespeare under his arm.
You might want to remind the listeners what Nielsen did.
Nielsen was known as the Muswell Hill murderer. He dismembered a lot of boys, 15 bodies. Some of them burnt in the garden of his flat in Cricklewood, and some he flushed down the loo in his flat in Muswell Hill.
How do you flush a body down the loo?
It's very difficult. In the end, the most famous quote of all, which one I've always adored, is the policeman. The local authority were called because, the drains were clogged up, and the senior investigating officer knocked on Nielsen's door and said, "We said, Mr. Nielsen, we've come to talk to you about the drains." And absolutely true. And they went into the flat and they opened the fridge door, discover a head.
Oh my God.
Yes. Nielsen was and is an extraordinary man. Doesn't speak to Brian now. He got rather annoyed with him at one point.
Perhaps we'll do him one day on the podcast.
Oh, he's a one of his victims was discovered in a pub less than 150 yards away.
Oh, we should definitely talk about him.
Yeah.
Good. I remembered something jolly that happened. My boss got a puppy.
Oh, nice. What sort?
My dog Betsy's not super keen on the puppy because Betsy doesn't really like other dogs, but she's tolerating her. She's a German wirehaired pointer called Peanut.
She's so sweet. Lovely.
It's really dreamy having a puppy around, although it doesn't help with the workload.
No, I can imagine that.
But she's super sweet. Oh, we all try and put a picture of Peanut on Instagram.
Yes, I'm very interested. But my friends at CBS Reality are very keen that we should put more things on Twitter. And
okay, well, we'll do that. We'll talk to our thanks to our producer Poppy. She also runs our Twitter and Instagram because we're not clever enough to do that.
No, we certainly aren't.
I don't even understand how Twitter works, really, still. But that doesn't mean that we wouldn't like you to follow us. We would, because there's stuff on there. So Blood Ties Podcast, Instagram, Twitter, and please do email us. bloodties.podcast@gmail.com, I think, is our email address, she said, hopefully.
I think it's right.
And thank you so much, Dad. And we will be back in 2 weeks.
We will.